Welcome to Puentes, Bridges to the Community. Hello, I'm your host, Emily Guerra. My guest on this edition is Distinguished Professor of History and Chicano-Latino Studies at the University of California, Irvine, Dr. Vicky L. Ruiz, award-winning scholar and educator and author of Mexican-American History. Thank you for visiting us here at New Mexico State University.
Well, thank you, Emily. I love being in this part of the world, and it's a pleasure to be here.
You got invited by our New Mexico State Honors College Assistant Professor, Dr. Isabella Quintana. You've been a mentor to her?
Yes, I have. Dr. Quintana received her PhD from the University of Michigan, and she applied for a UC Presidential Postdoctoral Fellowship. The UC Presidential Postdoc is designed to encourage outstanding African American, Latino, and some Asian American scholars from selected groups to help them transform their dissertations into a book by working with a senior scholar at a UC institution. It's a two-year postdoctoral fellowship, which really gives the kind of time that you need to turn sort of a raw project into a finished product. And I was very privileged to work with her for 2 years.
Well, that's one of your passions, working with students.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's wonderful to see students go from being interested in history and then pursuing it as a life's work, or watching an undergraduate find their own passion.
So 23 students that you've mentored.
Yes.
Since 1996, you've been mentoring students.
Yes, I have.
Well, tell me more about yourself. How did you get started in your life work in Chicana history? What does that mean?
Well, I think my love of history started from my family. I always say that my parents really didn't believe in television. And so I heard stories at the kitchen table, especially by my mother and my grandmother. My grandmother was born in Trinidad, Colorado, from an Hispano family in 1881. My mother was born in Walsenburg in 1921. Considered at the time the product of a mixed marriage because her father was a Mexicano immigrant from León, Guanajuato, and her mother was Hispana. And so they would talk about what was like growing up, my grandmother, about growing up in the ranchito and then growing up in the coal mines. And my mother would sort of go off from there and talk about her life growing up as a young adolescent in the Depression.
So you talked about being a mixed marriage, Hispana and Mexican.
In the 19-teens, that was because she was Hispana.
What do you mean by Hispana?
She was, you know, of the generations. They were from Mexico a very long time ago. And of the Spanish Americans. My late tia Beatriz would always say, I don't know why you call yourself Chicana. Because, you know, we're Spanish. And I said, your father was born in León, Guanajuato. You know, she would get very upset. But yeah, that's that tension. Absolutely, that's that Hispano-Mexicano tension that a lot of people don't really want to talk about.
And that don't understand.
And don't understand. And I think it's important to see that type of variations. And I see that in my students. My first job was at the University of Texas at El Paso. And a lot of my students, not only at UTEP, well, in UTEP in the early 80s, but also my graduate students who've come to work with me who are from Texas, they're Tejana, from New Mexico, Hispano. And then you go to California, people who are more likely to call themselves Chicano. But you have people who call themselves Mexican-American. Others prefer the more pan-Latino identity, like being Latino or being Hispanic, both of which have become sort of accepted umbrella terms. In fact, I tell students that there's never been any time in the history of Spanish speakers in what would become the United States where anyone agreed on a mutually agreeable name to call themselves, ever. In the 1830s, you had Tejanos, Californios, Hispanos, you never had. So when they say, well, we can't agree on a term, I say, well, that's nothing new. And it talks about the mosaic of Latino experiences. And I think that's one of the things I've tried to do, particularly in my later work, is talk about sort of what are both commonalities and differences among Spanish-speaking peoples in what would become the United States. What are the commonalities but differences if you're growing up Boricua in New York, or if you're growing up a Cubano in Florida, and perhaps Hispano in Santa Fe? And so that's one of the things I've in my own work now that I'm trying to do, is dealing with concepts of identity. And in fact, in the talk that I'm giving, it's comparing two Latina feminist intellectuals, one at the turn of the 20th century and the other in the 1920s, One is writing in Puerto Rico. One is writing in her native Guatemala. They are very different in orientation. Luisa Capetillo is organizing Puerto Rican agricultural workers. At the same time, she's writing about women's rights. Luisa Moreno is a sheltered socialite, a young adolescent growing up in privilege, who writes about women's education. So you have two very distinct, but yet in the United States, they would become known as radical labor leaders. And they wrote, and I love oral tradition, but we have actual documents of these women and what they wrote at the time, which were, particularly Luisa Capetillo, was very radical for the time period, the turn of the 20th century, before women got rid of the corset. She's talking about free love and companionate marriage, whereas Luisa Capetillo is much more, in the 1920s, is much more sheltered. And it's like, we have to have women's education to uplift our nation. If Guatemala wants to be a modern nation, the nation needs to educate its women. But it's also, she's doing a critique against popular culture. And it gets flappers, and it gets the type of Hollywood movies. And I think that this is talking about, these are traditions we don't know about. We often think about feminism and women's rights as something that belongs on the East Coast. It's about women's suffrage. But to look at it's just not Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz in the 17th century, the nun talking about women's rights. But we have this Latina sort of, I'm calling a feminist tradition. And in my latest work, I'm trying to sort of look at the differing strands and then what happened when women who are writing about feminism from where they grew up, Capetillo in Puerto Rico and Moreno in Guatemala, and then coming to the United States. My next book will be a biography of Luisa Moreno, the Guatemalan feminist intellectual who becomes a poet in Mexico City and consorts with the like of Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, and then comes to New York in 1928, a married woman, pregnant, and going to work in the garment districts of Spanish Harlem, and how that radicalizes her to become a labor leader. In fact, she becomes the first Latina to be a national vice president of a CIO union, the United Cannery Agricultural Packing and Allied Workers of America. She organized workers in New York, in Florida, in Colorado, in Texas, and in California. And in fact, organized the first Latino Civil Rights Congress in the United States, El Congreso de Pueblos de Habla Española. And that was her legacy. She tried to build bridges across groups, was a believer in immigrant rights, was someone who worked tirelessly for workers, and the cannery unions that she organized in Southern California during World War II had unprecedented benefits. For example, sick leave, a hospitalization plan, a legal plan, and also very industry-setting wages. So they really improved their wages. The women improved their working conditions. And so I'm writing about sort of her life and her story. In 1950, she was deported on grounds that she had been a member of the Communist Party, which she had been in New York between 1930 to 1935. So even though she was married, her third husband was a U.S. citizen whose mother belonged to the Daughters of the American Revolution, and her daughter had been born in the United States. And so she returned to her native Guatemala.
But you got to meet her in Mexico?
Yes, I did, because what happened was she's in Guatemala. She said she didn't have any sort of high-profile position at all. She was just working on rural women's education. What she had talked about as a young woman, she's actually doing it as a middle-aged woman in Guatemala under the Jacobo Arbenz government. And in 1954, after the CIA-sponsored coup, she had to flee to Mexico. And so I interviewed her in Guadalajara in 1978 when she was living there. She was a widow, and she supported herself by taking her husband's life insurance policy and contributions from friends in the United States. She bought three apartments, and she rented them out to U.S. medical students. That's how she made her living, because she could charge the Americanos more money. This is in Mexico, and that's where I met her, in Guadalajara.
Now, she was your inspiration, then, to study Chicana history or to start your work?
To start my work. I was interested. I went to Stanford because I wanted to bridge the narratives that I learned at the table with the printed, what I was reading in school, because there was no Mexican-American history. There was Ponce de Leon, there was the Alamo, and there was Pancho Villa. And my family's history wasn't part of any of that. And so I really, it wasn't until I was a senior in college and a professor gave me a copy of Rudy Acuna's Occupied America that I was like, wow, here are the stories that I grew up with. And I went to graduate school. I was very fortunate to be accepted into Stanford, where Albert Camarillo, who's now an endowed chair, was an assistant professor. And when I applied, he called me, talked to me for a half hour about my interest in Chicano history. Then he called my parents, and he talked to my parents for half an hour. After that, it was like, that was the only place I was going to go. And he and his colleague Estelle Friedman were very important mentors to me. But my dissertation topic, I was so enthusiastic. After my last day of my meeting with Luisa in 78, I said, I know what I'm going to do for my dissertation. I'm going to write about you. And she said, oh, no, you're not. She said, you're going to write about the cannery workers in Southern California. You go find these women. She said, those are the women you need to do. That's your topic. And it was my topic. You know, in oral history, you go to somebody's house and they really don't know you. You don't know them, but they share their memories with you. They share their stories. And I feel a great responsibility. And in my work, that I get their stories right. I interview someone, I will give them a copy of their transcript and say, please make any additions or deletions, something you're not comfortable with me telling the world. For me, it's an important sense of trust. And I really worry about reciprocity. I don't want people to think, oh, well, you know, you're going in there and you're sort of taking advantage of them. But people really enjoy telling their stories. You know, as I said, they have the opportunity to tell me, no, I really don't want this story out. And, you know, I respect that. But when Matil, Luisa's daughter, after Luisa's death in Guatemala, was sent her mother's things, and a package arrived, and she asked me to come by and help her unwrap the package, so I did the next day. And it was a blue suitcase. And in a blue suitcase was everything her mother had basically owed. There was a reboso. There were the reviews she kept of her poetry book that she published in 1927 in Mexico. She was like any writer. She kept her good reviews. And there were personal papers, her third husband's death certificate. And at the bottom of the suitcase lay my dissertation. So I felt like, you know, she had not only had mattered a great deal to me and influenced me professionally and personally, but I had mattered to her. And that is something that I will always carry with me.
So it's important then to be influenced by someone and to be a mentor.
Yes.
And how important is it for people to read these stories, to know about these stories?
I think it's very important to give a fuller recounting of the American narrative. What I try to do is look at, it's not just great political forces, great economic forces, great national, international leaders. Certainly, they're an important part of the story. But we have to look at the ways in which ordinary people made a difference in their families' lives and in their community. There's so many community leaders who are known only to the community, but who have made a tremendous difference in terms of quality of life, in terms of making their way in the world and making things better for their families.
Now, your most recent book, From Out of the Shadows, Mexican Women in 20th Century America. Now, these are women in the 1930s. You talk about deportation, repatriation, and poverty. Tell me a little bit about that book, and when did that come out?
The book was published in 1998, and then Oxford did a 10th anniversary edition with a new afterword in 2008. The book seeks to tell the story of the ways in which Mexican women in the 20th century contributed to their communities, the ways some of which assumed national leadership prominence, as well as looking at the ways in which people began to blend elements of their parents' culture with American culture that they received at school, that they received through consumer culture, and the way in which you could sort of navigate one's lives. I talk about women who went to World War II, the Rosie the Riveters. I talk about here, closer to home in New Mexico, about the women of Salt of the Earth, because I think it's not just the importance of the film, but the film was very important, but to document that history and the importance of showing that for union membership for Mexican Americans, it's never about sort of the man going off on strike, but it's a family affair and the involvement of the family. And one can see this from the turn of the 20th century with the Pacific Railroad strike in L.A. in 1903, all the way through to the United Farm Workers. And I think that's an important story to tell, that when you're talking about union activism and the working class, for Mexican Americans, you're talking about family and family
and
involvement.
And how important it is that women were involved.
Like, absolutely.
Cesar Chavez was...
There's his wife, Helen. There is Dolores Huerta. There's Jesse Govea. There are Esther Padilla. There's Jesse De La Cruz, Hope Schechter. The list goes on. And we need to talk about, when we're talking about Chavez, and certainly he was a very charismatic leader, but we also need to talk about the people sort of who built the movement and the labor of women and the labor of children.
And what about here on the border, the Mexican-American women here in this region? Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Well, I think there's a woman in El Paso that I think is she's an inspiration, Rosa Guerrero. I interviewed her in 1983. A former undergraduate of mine also interviewed her. And those two interviews combined, she is just a force of nature and someone who has really brought cultural arts to a national stage. When I was teaching at UT El Paso, I was a very young professor. I started teaching at 27, and I started teaching about the Farah strike based on some of research some friends had done at Stanford, as well as the archives at the Oral History Collection at UTEP. And I'm talking about it as a historian. And I have these two older women in the class who were very respectful and very smart, but all of a sudden they started giggling and nudging each other. It was like, this wasn't a typical reaction, so I sort of looked at them. And one of them said, oh, we're sorry, Dr. Ruiz, but we were there. So I just turned the class over to them. And they talked about it.
What strike was that?
The Farah strike of the 70s, 73, 74. There was a national boycott of Farah pants. Farah was once the largest private employer in El Paso. And the speed-ups and the quota systems that the workers found were not reasonable. They were unreasonable. And they began to organize under the Amalgamated Clothing Workers, and they went on strike. It was a two-year strike. There was a national boycott. And because of the national boycott, Farah had to come to the table. And it was a very divisive issue in El Paso. And some people really supported the strike, and others did not. Farah workers used to give leaflets to their kids to pass out because people were less likely to be abusive to a child. They would pick it in front of the Popular and other department stores that sold Farah goods in El Paso, and they found actually a stronger reception, you know, sort of outside of El Paso. Also, there is the wonderful new book by Monica Perales, a native from El Paso, Speltertown. It started with her family stories because both of her parents grew up in Speltertown. And talking about Speltertown from the perspective of the people who live there, the people who work there. And still today, even though Speltertown closed in the 70s, you have people who grew up there. And now you have their children, their grandchildren, still having reunions. It talks about the strength of the community within Mexican-American families.
The same thing in Grant County with Santa Rita Mines.
Yes, it's a sense of connection.
So what is the future of Latinas in U.S. history? Latina Legacies, tell me about that.
Latina Legacies is a collection of biographies with contributors. I contributed a biography of Luisa Moreno. My co-editor, Virginia Sanchez Coral, contributed a terrific article on a Puerto Rican activist, Antonia Pantoja. What we try to do is look at the ways in which women have made history. Like there is a wonderful biography of Adelina Otero Warren, who was the first Spanish-speaking woman to run for Congress in 1921 in New Mexico. She ran. She was the Republican standard bearer. She had won her primary and very narrowly lost. She also became a superintendent in the Santa Fe schools. I was a power in New Mexico education, and at the time was a very vocal opponent of boarding schools for Native Americans. And someone also later in life was very interested in Hispano arts and crafts and the importance of keeping Hispano customs and keeping them alive and not just subject to tourist commercial likes and dislikes.
And how important is that today?
I think it's very important. I think it's important that we keep alive that it's not just selling goods for tourists, but the importance of keeping the culture. It keeps the culture alive. It keeps the stories alive. There is an artist, Emma Barbosa, who said that stories are the spirit threads that connect generations. And I think also it's not just stories, but it's through artistic production. You know, it's through the poetry, it's through the dicho, it's through food. You know, it's through visual arts. It's through dance.
And I'll quote you what you said. The past becomes memory and then memory becomes history.
Because we do. Our histories are crafted in our memories, both public memory as well as private memories.
So for young Latinas now, what would you say to them to get them engaged, to have their passion?
I think it's important to tell the stories. I've been very privileged to have wonderful academic reviews of my work. But to me, the best review came from a letter I received from a Rio Hondo Community College student in California who wrote that, who thanked, who had read Shadows and said, "Thank you for giving me a history." That means a lot to tell those stories. It means a lot to, particularly for Latinos. Often in the media, Latinos are seen as people who arrived day before yesterday. And I think it's important for them to see the generations and that you see the imprint of Spanish speakers since at least Coronado in 1540. In fact, if you look at the area that is the United States, the first European language spoken in this area, it was Spanish. We seem to forget that St. Augustine was founded in 1565, and Jamestown is 1607.
So Spanish was the first language.
Yes, it's the area that would become the United States.
And it's important then to be a mentor. What would
Absolutely.
You say to students for them to be compassionate about being mentors in the future?
Our education is a great gift, but it's also a gift that has obligations and responsibilities. And that responsibility is to give back to the community, to give back, even if it's just, if you're an undergraduate, even it means going back to your school and tutoring, or going back and talking about how to do college essays. I was very proud of a Latina sorority, Phi Lambda Rho, on the Irvine campus, who did a sort of college application workshop with a nonprofit in Costa Mesa that works with youth, called SOY, Save Our Youth. And they spent the whole day with students going over their college essays, talking to them about college, about options. And I thought, yeah, this is sort of community engagement in action, because professors or administrators, we can go out and talk to students and we're like the talking heads, you know. But when you have student to student, that makes a real difference.
So they become the bridge, the puente.
Absolutely.
To the community as well.
So you have amazing resources here, certainly history professors at UTEP. There's Chavez Leva. There's also Professor Ernesto Chavez. And here at New Mexico State University, Dr. Isabella Quintana.
And you were her mentor.
Yes, I was her mentor.
And thank you again, Distinguished Professor of History and Chicano Latino Studies at the University of California, Irvine, Dr. Vicky Ruiz. Thank you.
Thank you.
For KRWG, I'm Emily Guerra.